It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been a little more than a year since Stephanie Pashman was named as CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development, the nonprofit that supports economic development in southwestern Pennsylvania. We're going to talk about her efforts to spur development and enhance the region's workforce. Stephanie Pashman, welcome to the Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. It's wonderful to be here.
The conference has been around for three quarters of a century. You're the first woman to lead the organization, and you come from the nonprofit world, not private business. So I want to ask you, how has that formed your leadership in the past year, what you've brought to the Allegheny Conference?
Sure. Well, the Allegheny Conference, as you said, is 75 years of civic leadership. So businesses coming to the table, taking off their corporate hats and saying, what can I do to make this region stronger? And I've built a career on that, on thinking about how we do right by our community and by the people around us. And so for me, I feel like I have spent my time this year thinking about two things. One, we've spent a lot of time thinking about how to strengthen the organization itself so we're even better internally to do what we do. But more significantly, we've launched an agenda focused on creating a next generation for all. So how do we be inclusive around a regional strategy for 10 counties, not just the city? How do we make sure we bring in those folks who are disenfranchised and may not have a seat at the table? How do we make sure that overall, we are bridging the old economy and the new economy. So I'm really defining my leadership around building bridges and being as inclusive as possible.
All right. So your brief tenure so far as leader of the conference, it's been dominated by attention, attempts to lure Amazon here. Did all that attention overshadow other development efforts, other developments?
No, actually, that attention was a gift to the conference because it showed me the way to do economic development even stronger, and it made it really easy to bring new partners and old partners and all the folks that we needed to the table to think about how we spur growth in the region. And so the effects of the Amazon operation were, number one, we now have the best partnerships and the best data and the story put together in the most coherent way that we have in a very long time in order to be able to recruit businesses for the 10-county region.
So you're better prepared for other efforts?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we actually are not only better prepared, but we're also on the national spotlight in a way that we weren't before. I mean, to be amongst the bedfellows of Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, this would be a dream for Pittsburgh 15 years ago. And now we're seen as, you know, competing with some of the biggest cities for the best opportunities in business growth.
All right. So I said at the very beginning, Allegheny Conference on Community Development, the nonprofit that supports economic development in southwestern Pennsylvania. What do you do?
What do I do? That's a great question,
Kevin. Not just you, but the organization.
Sure. So the organization, I'll give you a little bit of history lesson to help inform what we really do. 75 years ago, this year, Richard King Mellon looked around and said, the war is over, and Pittsburgh, not only is the air dirty, but we are a region that is falling behind other regions, and we need to come together. And he scheduled this epic lunch that actually was at the Omni William Penn. Every lunch since then has been at the Duquesne Club, but they started out at the Omni William Penn with CEOs, captains of industry, and said, we're going to take off our hats for our businesses and not worry about improving sales, but we're going to worry about fixing this region. And they started out by cleaning the air, and over the years, the conference has taken the long view of how we make the region stronger. So putting in place the RAD tax, putting in place the fixing the stadiums and building them over the times when it was falling apart, reinventing a diversified economy after the steel decline. So we are able to look at the region and say, how do we make sure this is a place that is the best place to live, work, and that we can bring business to the region.
But improving the region can also help the bottom line of those businesses participating.
No doubt. And that's absolutely, I'm sure, the motivation in the ultimate sense. And as an organization, we have a research arm that can help us inform what are the key problems here so we really can do great analytics. We oversee the Chamber of Commerce, so we have the ability to influence policy change at the local, state, and federal levels. We have a very robust communications infrastructure, so we can be the branding and marketing tool for the region. And then we have a 10-county economic development entity that focuses on attracting and expanding businesses in southwestern Pennsylvania.
You used the term partnerships, but what can the conference do that the city, the county, and their respective development departments, their development arms, can't do?
So we can do a few things. One is we, first of all, can look across the 10-county region. And I think that that is really critical, is that we can make sure that as a broad economic base that the region grows and be somewhat agnostic as to whether or not a business locates in Indiana County, Lawrence County, or in the core of Bakery Square. And so it's in our best interest to overall try and think about the region broadly. We're also more nimble because we're not constrained necessarily by public rules that may not change as quickly as the economic development climate does. And so we have the ability to bring whoever we need to the table, think about trying new and different things, being as innovative and as flexible and nimble as we can in moving the region forward. Mm-hmm.
A little bit about the process. How do things come together? And I know it'll vary from, you know, project to project, but how do things come together when you are pursuing a development and courting an investor for the region?
Sure. So first of all, you should understand that we have a really good sense on what's in our economy and the kinds of businesses that make sense to fit in. And because we are diversified, we have a lot of ways that we can focus on growing five key sectors: energy, healthcare, financial services, tech, and I'm forgetting the fifth, but it'll come to me in a second. Anyway, we are focused on building key sectors in the economy. And as we do that, we keep our eyes on the national landscape as to what we hear from site consultants and real estate partners. And so we have a very strong web of relationships on a national and international basis that are keeping an eye on where the opportunities are. And there are both RFPs that come into us that we respond to, that kind of are a cold call from us to say we're open for business, and we put together a package to bid. And then we also have folks that come to us because they know what Pittsburgh is about and what kinds of business would make sense here. And so we have a network of relationships, and then we also locally work with the universities, the city, the county economic development, and our regional economic development partners to think about what land they have available, what kind of business that they want to bring in. And so we can strategically go out and target companies on a national basis that may make sense for Pittsburgh.
You used the term agnostic. And
yes.
You also said 10 counties in this region. So how do you make sure, when you're helping to lure a developer here, and there are maybe several sites that are potential good locations, one's in this county, one's in this municipality, et cetera, that you're not pitting one against another?
So we're really a sourcing operation, right? So we have a very broad database of all the real estate parcels available, and we're working with companies who know what they want and know what's good for their business. And so typically, the actual process is a negotiation with that business, what they want. But the good thing about it is when we bring businesses in, it benefits the broad region in terms of jobs and overall improving our economic base. So even if the real estate may be in a certain county, the benefit for job opportunities and overall supply chain effects could be broader than just that local real estate operation.
You mentioned the industry sectors that you sort of focus on, key ones, and the geography. But how do you make sure, what is your role in making sure that development is equitable, that, you know, that everyone participates, that it benefits the region and all the people in the region?
Sure. So that's actually been a bit of a cornerstone of our agenda that we launched in January about creating a next generation economy for all. And so that means several things. That is, first of all, that we have to understand the nature of the businesses that operate here that want to expand and help them, inspire them around opportunities to bring in different types of individuals. It also is about making sure that our workforce agenda and the talent operation that we are running has an integration to the economic development operation. And so we can offer companies the ability to grow their talent pool in an equitable way while they are also growing their businesses. So we have a very robust workforce and talent operation that came out of, I think, the Inflection Point study that we did a few years ago under my predecessor that helped define the talent needs in the short and long term for the region. And with that, we've set up different ways of approaching strategies to keep people here and think about diverse talent.
Right. I want to follow up on that, the Inflection report. And also, when I talked to Rich Fitzgerald last week, he mentioned some of the feedback that you and he and the other partners received from Amazon had to do with workforce development. And there was some pointing out of some shortcomings there. So what can be done to prevent that sort of criticism or pointing that out? And number two, you mentioned that report of a couple years ago, which talked about thousands of jobs that would be short people that would be short to fill the jobs in by 2025. So is it numbers of jobs that'll be open, a lack of people, or is it just not quite having the right fit?
So a couple points to make. So first of all, on the Amazon piece, you have to look that we just lost out to a city with an 8 million person population and a city with 5, 6 million person population. So in terms of scale of population, it's pretty significant for Pittsburgh to be able to compete at that level. So when they talked about workforce, they were talking about sheer numbers, that we just don't have the size and scale of a city like a New York or a Washington, D.C. But more significantly, one of the challenges that we've highlighted, and the conference newly is coming out with a bit of a regional scorecard to help drive all of us towards, you know, our opportunity and where we can improve, is that we're not necessarily growing. And so we unfortunately look at cities like Nashville that, you know, won a piece of the Amazon Prize with 5,000 jobs, and they're growing about 10%, if not more, over the last 5 years, while we barely grew at all, if grew. And so I think one of your points around our workforce shortages, it's twofold. One is we have to have everybody that we are here in our region that is born and bred in Pittsburgh has to participate in the workforce. And we have to make sure that we are doing the best we can to bring them through our schools and build their talents so that they are skilled for the jobs locally. But at the same time, we have to go out on a broad basis and open up Pittsburgh and be able to attract folks. And we're already seeing incredible growth in our millennial populations of people who are seeing the jobs here, who are coming in and starting to settle in Pittsburgh because of our quality of life, our cost of living, and the job opportunities available. And we need to do more of that to fuel that growth.
In our last 20 seconds, and that concept of equitable applies to development and the workforce as well.
Absolutely. The equitable at the core is about at the workforce and making sure that folks find their place in that workforce and that our companies are open to non-traditional populations and create cultures that are inclusive.
Stephanie Pashman is the CEO of the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Stephanie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a pleasure.
And you're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
To call Frank Zappa prolific would be a massive understatement. Zappa released 62 albums while he was alive, and the Zappa Family Trust has given us another 49 since his passing. Born Frank Vincent Zappa, not Francis, in December 1940, Zappa was a guitarist, a singer, songwriter, bandleader, and provocateur, not to mention his political activism. He railed against the government, organized religion, and censorship, often through music, but sometimes in court. Frank Zappa passed away 25 years ago today after losing his battle with prostate cancer. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh has hosted arts events in junkyards, on river barges, in empty swimming pools, and underground, inside an old limestone mine. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll visited this year's incarnation of the art project called Subsurface.
If you've ever wondered what a robotic bagpipe sounds like inside an inactive limestone mine, Subsurface is your best bet. Subsurface was created by two professors at Carnegie Mellon University and debuted last year. This year, about 250 patrons gathered on a rainy Saturday for a 90-minute bus ride from CMU north into farm country. We ended up in Brady's Bend, Pennsylvania, at the unassuming front door of a facility built right into a wooded hillside.
Hello. Hi there. Welcome. How are you?
Inside that door was the Brady's Bend Corporation mine. For more than a century, it was an active limestone mine with a vast maze of tunnels. At 50 million square feet, it has more floor space than the largest building in the world. The tunnels run for 600 miles, and none has ever seen the light of day.
If you want it to be, it can be the darkest place you've ever been, the quietest place you've ever been, and that's an incredible canvas if you're a musician or an artist.
Jesse Stiles is the CMU music professor who helped create Subsurface. He and art professor Rich Pell noted its ties to Pittsburgh's history. The mine was first owned by U.S. Steel.
This limestone mine is a space that we created in the building of our city because limestone is key to the production of steel and to the production of cement. And so this negative space that we created in the earth is a byproduct of the existence of Pittsburgh. It's a negative Pittsburgh.
But now, for an hour at least, it's also a subterranean playground for artists and musicians. Down in the mine, it's cool but not cold, and it's not cramped either. The passages are 20 feet wide, with ceilings you'd need a ladder to reach. Subsurface is funded mostly by Carnegie Mellon. Stiles and this year's co-organizer, art professor Scott Andrew, drew from their students and the wider CMU community, including two music ensembles Stiles plays in. About 50 performers are scattered along one stretch of the labyrinth. With dramatic lighting, often in purple and green, they play musical instruments and wear fantastical costumes. None of the characters speaks. The performers include a woman wearing an orange ski mask and cat suit with a traffic cone bustier, riding a bicycle while three musicians in white coveralls play recorders. Walk on through the darkness and you'll see a figure in a long cloak embedded with pinpoint LED lights, wearing a translucent birdcage-like headpiece that glows from within. Wander away from the crowd and some parts of the mine sound like this, total silence. But with performers near and music playing, there's the feeling of an eerie traveling carnival. Surprisingly, there's hardly any echo in here, but the sound carries a long way.
You can't just, like, play Brahms in a limestone mine and have that make any sense.
Music professor Jesse Stiles and his colleagues composed new music for this site. For the big concluding number, some performers are adorned with colorful glowing wires, while others are completely obscured by costumes made from long strips of multicolored fabric like shaggy beasts. Musicians play drums, tuba, saxophone, trumpet, violin, electronics, and musical saw. The costume creatures do a kind of ritual dance. Finally, there's a closing processional. Patrons are handed kazoos to play along as they march out of the mine. The mine was active until 2016 and is now used mostly for storing boats and cars in its constant 55-degree low-humidity environment. It's run by Brady's Bend Corporation, whose owner is a CMU alumnus. Many guests were Carnegie Mellon students or staff. Melody Harris works at Chatham University, but learned about subsurface from a friend at CMU.
I loved it. I thought it was super interesting. It's psychedelic and a little scary, and I felt like I was on another planet and breathing different oxygen, and it was populated by friendly monsters.
Stiles says the series should continue with another installment next year. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
You're listening to The Confluence. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Supreme Court is considering whether to limit the practice of civil asset forfeiture, a long-time legal practice used by some law enforcement agencies to seize property and keep it to fund their own operations. We're going to discuss the implications of this case on law enforcement and the people who are losing their property. Joining us in studio is David Harris, University of Pittsburgh law professor, WESA's legal analyst, and host of the podcast Criminal Injustice. Welcome, David.
Good to be with you, Kevin.
Let's start with a few of the basics at this point. First, what's the difference between criminal forfeiture and civil forfeiture?
Well, for our purposes, there isn't much of a difference. What we're talking about are cases in which there is an allegation that criminal conduct has occurred and that a particular thing, a pile of money, a car, a boat, any kind of property was used in the commission of the crime. In a case like that, irrespective of whether there is a criminal conviction, the government can effectively sue the assets, the money, the things, and ask the court to give those assets to the government as kind of ill-gotten gains. This has been around for a long time, but it's only been in the last few decades that things have really changed.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about that change in a minute. Is this done in every state or not?
I don't know if it's done in every state, but it's so common it might as well be. It's everywhere, and then there is a widespread federal program that allows for the same kinds of seizures. So effectively, it's everywhere in the United States.
Okay, and we're going to talk about where it's happening and the implications. Joining us now is Angela Erickson, A research analyst who previously worked for the Institute of Justice, the group that argued this case for the plaintiff to the high court last week, and she's written extensively on the subject. And also on the line from Kentucky is Sergeant Tullio Torino of the Louisville Police Department. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Okay, let us, Angela, I want to get your sense of just how widespread, how widely is the forfeiture used across the country since you've researched this extensively?
Civil forfeiture has been growing at every level over the past decade, and we see it more and more often. And so if we're looking at sort of the federal government since 2001, it's been over $29 billion that they have forfeited from citizens. And this includes both criminal and civil forfeiture. And part of the problem is that there's not good data to separate the two. And then we also see it growing at the state level. The problem with states is that they don't typically report, and so it's a little more difficult to see. But for those of your listeners who are in Pennsylvania, in 2000, it was about $6 million that the state was taking through forfeiture, and by 2013 it was up to almost $11 million.
Mm-hmm. Sergeant, so it is done in Kentucky as well, correct? It is used.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We see this quite rampant in Kentucky, and we have serious issues concerning the reporting of the monies that are generated through these forfeitures.
Okay. I wanted to get all of you on this. So what are people being convicted of, accused of, who have their property seized? David, we're going to start with you and then go around.
Well, the thing is with asset forfeiture, Kevin, they don't actually have to be convicted of anything at all.
This charged?
They could be, and they could be convicted, but they don't have to be. That's the thing. It is completely independent of the criminal process. Now, many people who do face a criminal charge and are convicted, they could have their assets forfeited, but that's not actually necessary. The forfeiture process stands absolutely independent of the criminal process, and so you have the spectacle of a lot of people never being charged or even being acquitted, but their property is still subject to forfeiture.
Okay, Angela.
Yeah, so how this works is you have, instead of the case being against a person, it's against the property. And so the person doesn't have to be charged of anything at all. And the property, it's the burden of proof is actually really low for law enforcement in order to forfeit the property. And so most of these seizures that we see are being done under the premise that it's related to drugs somehow, even if there's not drugs on site. And in order for the owner of that property to get it back, they have to prove that their property is innocent. So it's this topsy-turvy world where their property is guilty, essentially, until they prove that it is innocent.
Is that across the board or a different state? Follow up with you, Angela. Or is it vary from state to state? The property is at the heart of it.
So the property is always at the heart of it. In terms of the burden of proof, that varies a little bit. Almost every state requires the owner to prove that their property is innocent. There are some states that have stronger protections that require the law enforcement or prosecutors to prove that the property was part of a crime.
Mm-hmm. Tullio, from the law enforcement perspective, you used the term rampant before. How is civil asset forfeiture, how is that beneficial for your department or other police departments?
Well, certainly there's a matter of revenue that is generated through asset forfeiture that benefits police departments but more especially the prosecutor's office. So there isn't really a separation of power, so to speak. There isn't an accountability that is taking place, because when you have money involved, obviously there's a motivation to engage in these types of activities if it's going to benefit the department financially. But as an example, if I may say, the Timms case currently being heard in the Supreme Court, where the gentleman was stopped lawfully. He was engaged in trafficking in heroin, actually, or was selling heroin. But the vehicle that he possessed was completely purchased legally without the use of funds that were generated from his heroin sales. And so his vehicle was seized and it was forfeited unto the state. And that's just an example of how something that is completely unrelated to the crime itself can be seized by the government and taken as property and sold at auction or even assimilated into the fleet, for example, like his car probably was of the department that affected the arrest.
It sounds like you have a problem with that because it was purchased with funds other than that were acquired illegally through the sale of drugs.
Correct. And I think Angela can speak more to that because there's a legal matter and there's also an ethical matter. And it certainly doesn't look, it doesn't create a sense of justice within the community and even within the police department that you're engaged in an activity that benefits the police department through an unethical means. Once again, I think most of the issues arise with the fact that revenue is generated through the seizing of property that doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the criminal activity itself, nor is the defendant offered the due process that criminals would be offered when it comes to what exactly is seized.
Angela?
Yeah, so there's a couple issues here. So one is what this case was arguing, which is that there's a constitutional right to be protected against excessive fines, and we can come back to that. And the other issue is that law enforcement shouldn't be out there bringing in their own revenue, right? We have separation of powers for a reason. And when they bring in their own revenue, there's potentially a conflict of interest. And it creates what we term policing for profit.
Policing for profit, David Harris. It's, well, I guess one could argue, well, the taxpayers don't have to fund the police departments as much as they might have to. So there.
Well, it's true, but I don't think that's the way we want to run public policy mm-hmm. or public institutions. Public institutions like police departments, like courts, they should run on taxpayer money because they pursue and perform a public function. If we put the police out there and say, earn your budget or earn some big part of your budget by seizing citizens' property, police officers are human beings. Police departments are human institutions. They will respond to the incentives we put in front of them. And we don't want them using law enforcement to fund themselves, to gather the funds that they need to operate. Rather, that should be appropriated through the regular legislative process and given to them through the taxpaying public. That's the way we want things, and that's the way we can control things and have accountability. The forfeiture process funding law enforcement has probably been the single biggest problem that we have had with forfeiture. That's what's caused it to grow and grow and grow, and that's what's caused the abuses. And states have responded to that by limiting the power of their own police departments to collect the revenue. And then the federal government basically created a workaround. That's why we still have this problem.
We're talking about civil asset forfeiture and the potential impact of a Supreme Court ruling on both law enforcement and the people who are losing their property. We're going to continue our conversation when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA. It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA, and we're talking about a case before the U.S. Supreme Court involving civil asset forfeiture. And we're going to pick up there on the Supreme Court because Sergeant Tulio Torreno mentioned it, and Angela and David have addressed it. But I want to go a little bit more to the heart of it. What is being asked here of the Supreme Court? Angela, let's start with you. Is it just to overturn it? Is it the extent of the penalties? What?
So the case is specifically looking at the constitutional issue of excessive fines language in the Eighth Amendment. And according to the Indiana attorney for the state, the excessive fines provision in the Bill of Rights does not apply to states. And so there's this question of whether or not it is fully incorporated, which means does this particular provision of the Bill of Rights apply to states? And what this means is excessive fines in the case of Timms is pretty clear, So the extent of the fines, there's usually a maximum amount number fine for a case. And in his case, it was $10,000 was the maximum fine that they could take from him. In the case of his vehicle, it was well worth more than $40,000. And so it's pretty clear that it's excessive. So the question is, does that apply to the state of Indiana?
The vehicle that was seized, as you mentioned a little bit earlier before the break, was not acquired with illegal money from drug deals, correct?
Yes. Okay. So the vehicle in question, the reason why the state believes that it's forfeitable is because it was used to drive to a place to hand off drugs to an undercover officer. So it was part of the process of committing the crime. As the IJ attorney, Wesley Hoddit, mentioned, you know, this is a rural area. People drive everywhere, right? It's incidental.
Okay. IJ, Institute of Justice. David, explain to us this particular distinction within the Bill of Rights.
Right.
Angela mentioned the Eighth Amendment, but weren't some of the Bill of Rights sort of incorporated into the 14th?
Well, here's how it works. The Bill of Rights was part of our original Constitution as the first 10 amendments, but they only applied to the federal government, and there was no application to the states at all. It only limited the federal government. It's only in the 20th century, really, that people start looking at individual pieces of the Bill of Rights and saying, this is fundamental to our country, to our democracy, to due process, so much so that it is, this particular provision is incorporated into the 14th Amendment to the Constitution post-Civil War that does apply to the states, and therefore it applies across the nation. So you had various pieces of the Bill of Rights, one at a time, applied to the states. There, at this point, there aren't very many left that have not been applied to the states. Even within the Eighth Amendment itself, the excessive bail clause has been applied to the states, but not the excessive fines clause. So that's the question in front of the Supreme Court, if the excessive fines clause will apply to the states, and then we have to decide, was any particular forfeiture within that?
All right, quick follow-up with you,
sure.
And that is, what's excessive? Who gets to decide it? And I believe the Supreme Court justices, they even asked the two attorneys, are you wanting us to set a limit or not? Or are you just saying no excessive and then you determine it?
Well, I would predict what's going to happen is they'll say, the Supreme Court will say, a forfeiture can be, the excessive fines clause applies to the states. A forfeiture can be within that. And then they will leave it to lower courts to work out the details, not just in this case, but a kind of formula, ways of going forward. And then they may have to regroup and decide a future case to get to the details of what's excessive. That's not something they'll do right now.
Sergeant Tullio Torino of the Louisville Police Department. Does your state have a determination of what is excessive?
No, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, not only do we not have that determination, we also don't have any guidelines or laws that specifically require reporting of how much is being seized. So I think that there's a large vacuum, legally speaking, that needs to be filled through the advancement, either through the Supreme Court decision or locally here, in order to make these determinations more clear.
Follow up. Would you like some guidelines? Would they be helpful? And what might that help look like, Sergeant?
Oh, absolutely. The organization I work with, the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, LEAP, you can visit us at www.lawenforcementaction.org. We're basically a nonprofit group that is formed by current and retired police, judges, other justice professionals, criminal justice professionals that work on policing and criminal justice issues and drug policy. And I think we agree that in order for us to build better relationships of trust between the community and the police, which is imperative in the advancement of police services and the solving of criminal matters, we need to have more transparency and better guidelines so the community doesn't perceive these issues of forfeiture as a form of abuse of power. And I think for for most of us, we see this as being a loophole that police departments can take advantage of, once again, in order to generate revenue for their own departments and for the prosecutor's office.
David Harris.
Boy, I think that's a great point by the sergeant. You know, he really does the right thing when he connects this to the issue of public confidence and trust. The public may not understand all the nuances of the legalities, all of that, but they certainly understand fairness. And when they see something like this, a man did a wrong thing, he sold $250 worth of heroin, then they seize his $42,000 vehicle and keep it themselves and maybe fund their department with it, that breaks down trust. And trust is the heart of cooperation with the police, and we all know police can't solve the crime problems in any community alone. They need the public's cooperation.
We've just a couple of minutes left, Angela, and I want you to chime in here. But we've been talking about this Indiana case, and a crime was committed, but there's also other people who are indirectly, I can't even say involved, innocent third parties where maybe, I don't know, a son had marijuana or drugs in the house, and then somebody goes after that car or that house. So there are innocent third parties that are being affected as well, are there not?
Yeah, so in Philadelphia, there's a story that comes out where a home was seized, a parent's home was seized because their son sold $40 worth of drugs outside the home, on the sidewalk outside the home. So an entire home was taken, and these people didn't know what was happening, the parents. They literally locked them out of their home and left all of their possessions inside their home so they couldn't access it. And this type of stuff, it's not American, right? We don't punish people without a conviction, without charging them. And we should make sure that we're protecting people who are innocent.
All right. Sergeant, very briefly, what are you looking for? What are you hoping for comes out of the Supreme Court? Just very briefly, please.
Ultimately, we just want to support the use of forfeiture only if it's accompanied by a criminal conviction and perhaps reduce the profit motive. Other than that, we can't expect very much from a Supreme Court decision at this point, that, as far as I can tell.
And how could that possibly change how officers do their work?
I think it would make it clear, once again, build trust between the officer and the community. And honestly, just exercising common sense, if you're going to seize somebody's vehicle without due process, then what's to say that the clothes he bought isn't also used with that kind of money? The food he eats, the backpack of his kids, anything and everything can be subject to seizure. And I think we need to make that clear that that's not acceptable.
All right. David Harris, final question to you, and that is, what comes next? When will SCOTUS, the Supreme Court, decide? If they do opt to change the policy, how might that affect us in Pennsylvania?
Well, as Nina Totenberg always says, the decision will come by summer, by the end of June, with the end of the Supreme Court term. And it will affect officers if the Supreme Court incorporates the excessive fines clause. They will have to limit that activity, and legislatures will begin to step in, too.
All right. And how might that affect us here in Pennsylvania? Would take the legislature to then do that follow-up, maybe?
You will have new police department policies and perhaps some new state law on forfeitures.
Are you aware of anything being sort of floated around Harrisburg, just sort of at this point,
no, but they're going to have to react if this comes.
All right. David Harris is University of Pittsburgh law professor, host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast, and is WESA's legal analyst. Angela Erickson is a research analyst who worked for the Institute of Justice. And also, we've had Sergeant Tullio Torino of the Louisville Police Department. Thanks to all of you.
Good to be with you.
Thank you very much.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, the new General Assembly session won't start till January, but lawmakers are already floating their ideas for legislation. We'll speak with the Senate Democratic leader, Jay Costa. And what are educators doing to help ease the nursing shortage in our region? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Meg Fair and Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.